Hey, everybody. How you doing? We're just going to jump right on in. My name is Phil Stamper. I'm here with the great, the big 80s. Donnie B is here.
Yes.
How are you this week, sir?
I'm good, bro. Just got back from our yearly trek to Hershey Park out in beautiful Hershey, PA. We love it. My kids love it. We went with some friends of ours, and I highly recommend it. It's one of my favorite amusement attractions in the United States. Very clean, very well run, very affordable. Easy to get to, just a lot of fun. You can bang out the entire park pretty much in like one day. No need to stay there for like 5 days and all that shit. But we loved it. Great times. And once again, they got me at Chocolate World. Every time I go in, I swear we're not going to buy much. And then just with friends and family and upcoming parties and this and that, we just wind up leaving with a couple. He knows.
I know. I got kids.
Yeah, brother. You know, brother.
Well, speaking of which, the man who celebrated his birthday last week.
Yeah, speaking of Hershey, like I know it's not the same, but this is what my kids get me. Reese's.
Did you just bring out a bag that said happy birthday?
Reese's.
Whoa.
Reese's. You see the theme here?
I'm guessing this theme.
A Reese's bar. And more Reese's. So, yeah.
Now I have a question here. I'm a Reese connoisseur myself of many years. So I'm the one from the school that there's only one Reese cup, like the original Reese cup. I don't get all the different offshoots and Reese cups with M&Ms in it or Reese cups with marshmallow on, all that shit. Are you in the camp that there's only one true Reese cup and all these others are facsimiles or cheap knockoffs? Like, you know what I mean? All the different.
So, Reese's. So I'll add to that because the Reese's like egg and the other shapes, they change the texture, like the context of like what's equal to chocolate versus peanut butter has like that play on it. So when you have the Reese's egg, it's more peanut butter than chocolate. The same thing with the pumpkins during Halloween.
I could not agree more. The
trees during Christmas.
Yes, yep. I agree. It's not the same. Frozen original Reese cup has a nice thickness to its shell.
I will say, I do indulge in the white chocolate every now and then.
Ooh,
that was my nickname. I do indulge in those.
Bill, that was my nickname down in MCW. Ask Corporal about
white chocolate.
White chocolate, Donnie B. When I managed two dope, and sideswipe. That was my nickname.
That's going to be how I lead into my next conversation with him. Hey, I heard from White Chocolate.
Just tell him. If you look at Dan and say, yo, White Chocolate, Donnie B says hello, he'll just start uncontrollably laughing. I can guarantee it. I'll bet you anything you want, bet.
Well, Chris Bristow, you know, last week was your birthday, but that was just the prequel, if you will, because this week is my birthday. That's right. This whole week is my birthday. We're celebrating all week long.
The man
with
of
joy.
Week, yeah.
But you know what? I think we have some. I hear somebody walking up the path.
Here we go.
Donnie B, would you like to make a very special introduction to our guest of the evening?
Oh yes, that's cool. Okay, the individual. I just texted him we were going to be on a few minutes. But here we go. So the individual that we're having on tonight. I thought of this a few weeks ago. I said, on this podcast, I want to gear more towards folks who deserve more spotlight, a little more attention for the hard work they're doing. When you talk about pillars in the wrestling community and bastions of knowledge and pillars of knowledge, there's really only a few people. If you really stop and think about it, there's not like a college that cranks out professors of scholars of law and all that, like for wrestling. There's in my opinion, other than Jim Cornette, Jim Ross, I guess Meltzer to an extent. Exactly. I'm trying to think. There's probably only four or five people in the country that have as much knowledge when it comes to the territorial system or days of yesteryear and the history of professional wrestling as the guests we're having on tonight. I met this gentleman back in the late 90s. He came up through the indie circuit as a heel manager, much like myself. The good part about this guy was we had him on so many Dennis Carluzzo shows, and he was such a rascally rabbit. You just wanted to literally beat him to death on shows, which made it easy because it was hard to book indie shows when you have two top, what I call top tier heel managers. They kind of cancel each other out. So most of the time I was the babyface by default, mainly because the guest we have on tonight was so hateable and people just wanted to see him get his ass kicked, which is what happened 99% of the time. Me being the booker, I put myself over on him. But it made for good sense, too, because you wanted to see the heel get his comeuppance. And the crowd, every interaction him and I ever had always brought the house down. The people always popped. Exactly, dude. That was my ovation, not his. But, obviously, the gentleman we're talking about, he had a hell of a career inside the ring, all over the country. People don't realize how much he did. And the work he's currently doing, and he's been doing it for years, mapping out the territory system, really should be taught in every wrestling school. It should be taught in the PC. I know they like to scrub history a little bit and not really talk about the actual history of the business, just the history that they have. You know, to the victors go the spoils. You know, they write the history. But I think books like his and knowledge like his need to be passed down, mainly because when it's gone, it's gone. Like when Cornette is no longer here or Jim Ross is no longer here, or like, these are the pillars of knowledge, bro. These are the Aristotle.
It's that tribal knowledge that gets lost.
Yeah, man. These are the Socrates of pro wrestling. Like
it's the same thing of when you have like, when you're at a job and that one person that did everything that was like so nuanceical leaves the company. And then the company is like, doesn't know what to do. So it's one of those scenarios.
Yeah, like people, Phil, you know, like you've heard the name Toots Mont and Teeny Jarrett and Nick Goulas and all these promoters. Like I say some of these names when I ran the show in December, like a couple years, like 2 years ago, whatever it was. I was having a conversation with a top guy and we were talking about old school promoters and stuff. I'm telling you, even some of the guys in our locker room looked at me like, huh? Like they had no fucking idea who I was talking about. And I just said to myself, there really needs to be more of a roadmap or an emphasis on knowledge and teaching. Like, I'll give you a quick story, and I know our guest might know this story too, but when Nova was head of
development. Would you like to introduce who our guest is before you get there?
Well, I just want to put him over real quick. But I just want to tell the story real quick, and then we'll bring him on. But okay. When Nova was in charge of developmental down in, developmental for WWE, one of his things he did, he used to have quizzes, like actually written quizzes, and he would – it would be based on some of the wrestlers' books. So I remember he went out of pocket and bought Dr. Det's book for everybody in the class in OVW. And he gave it to everybody. He told everybody, we're going to do a book report on this. Yeah, a book report, and we're going to have a test on Dr. Det, who literally, you know, he's done a few things. And he was astounded at how poor the quality was. He said out of, I think, like 35 or 40 quizzes and book reports that they did, only one of them was passable. The rest were beyond terrible. He didn't have the heart to tell Dr. Det that. Like, he just told me, everybody loved your book. Like, he was devastated by that, Doc. But without further ado, I want to bring this guy on. I want to talk about the past. I want to talk about what he's doing. He's one of my favorites from my time in the business. Just a good, down-to-earth, good brother. Without further ado, let's bring him on. I know him as the Duke of New York, Al Getz. We all know him online as Alan Barry. So let's bring on my old friend, Al Getz.
Hey guys, how's it going? What a great intro, Donnie. Your check is in the mail. I used the Coraluzzo post office, so it might be a little late, but it's on the way. Trust me.
It says Spalding on it, I'm sure.
Hey, Phil. Hey, Chris. How you guys doing?
Good. Good to see you. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. Well, you know, that was a great introduction by Donnie. And, you know, like you said, we first met when I came to work for Dennis, and I was a heel manager. And he was a heel manager. And at first you're like, well, what do you do? And in the past, when I was in situations like that, when I was an indie manager, I was usually like a clear distant second. There were some other heel managers in the South that were really good. So I sort of went into a more comedic role. But the way things were going with Donnie, because he had been the regular, the incumbent up in New Jersey for so long, that it just felt natural to see if we can get the fans to cheer for him and Rick Ratchet. So if people ask me what I thought of myself as a manager, I'd say, I don't know if I was any good, but I actually got people to cheer for Rick Ratchet. So that's almost impossible. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty good. So basically the feud was I was managing Steve Corino against Ratchet and Donnie, built up to the show at the Gilbert Memorial, where Donnie ended up getting me after the match and legitimately ripping out a nice hunk of my hair and beating the crap out of me. And it was awesome.
Well, that was an accident. I apologize.
It wasn't because, you know, we did a thing where he slammed my head into the guardrail and I said, hold on. As I said, you know, keep hold of my hair. And then I took a bump to the floor really quickly. Mm-hmm. So he had no choice, but he was still holding on my hair and the hair just ripped out. And look at me now. There you go.
Donnie, do you have one of those signs that say like accident workplace is here?
Zero days.
In indie wrestling, I think it never got past 2 days.
No, but that's what was great about Al. When he came in, I think the first time I met you, you were actually managing, if I remember correctly, the first time I met you was the Mike Illions tournament. I think you came up with Joey Matthews, correct?
I actually didn't manage him on that show, but I did a promo to set that up.
Didn't I come out and beat you up on that?
This was literally, talking about legitimate injuries, you know, things that were planned out. This was not planned out ahead of time at all. I was doing an interview, and I'll be honest, I went way too long, and I was losing the crowd. And I think, Donnie, if I recall correctly, I think Mike Johnson was standing next to you, or somebody was standing next to you and said, just go in there and beat this guy up.
I think he said spear him. I think he said just go in and get him.
Without having called anything ahead of time, without having ever worked before, he just comes in the ring and, you know, goes to town on me, gives me the spear. I take a bump through the ropes. The crowd gives a big pop. And that's what sort of set the wheels in motion for what we would do in the future on Dennis's shows.
100%. And what was so great about Al, a lot of guys would come in. I'd seen it before. Heel managers from other places, like, you know, Big League, and just he acquiesced easily. And it was no ego thing. Like he said, you could have a show with two heel managers on it, but when you have two great heel managers, you have none, because one is going to overshadow and one's going to be in the bigger spot, whatever. So I just knew it was natural. I was like, why not just do this? It makes fucking sense. If I'm standing next to Al, we were both in our prime managerial shapes. Like, you know, he just looked like a guy that you wanted to slap in the face. So I'd put him with somebody like Corino, and, you know, he was just fantastic. Like, we just had so much fun. And even thinking back to our peers, We were just as good as them. Like, you know, I always say that to everybody. Like, I always thought you deserved better. I don't know outside in the real world, like, what you pursued and how far you tried to go and this and that. But you, rest assured, having seen and studied the business for 40-something years of my life, you easily could have been on TV every fucking week.
We were born a little too late. But, you know, it's interesting in that what I wanted to do when I first got into indie wrestling has sort of led me to what I do now. I read the Apter mags as a kid growing up, and I thought it was so cool that guys could go to Florida and stay there for 6-8 months, and then go to Texas and stay there for a year, and then go to Portland. And I wanted to do that when I first got into wrestling. And of course, the territories had died out by the mid late 90s, but because indie wrestling was still so strong and because the internet was just becoming a thing, I was able to, you know, leverage some relationships I had with Dennis, with Roland Alexander in California, with Burt Prentice in Nashville, with some promoters in Florida and in Michigan, that to much the extent as I could, I did get to work all those places just like I had wanted to when I was reading the magazines.
Incredible. Phil, I don't know how much you know about the old territory days. I think you're pretty well-versed, and Chris, you too, but Getz, maybe you could just, for those that are listening for this time, give us a little summation, and we're going to get in-depth with it. When did you come up with the idea for what you're currently doing, and explain what you're currently doing? I know what you're doing, but explain it to the folks that are listening out there.
Well, I have a website, a podcast, and a series of books, and they're all under the brand Charting the Territories. And this goes back to as a kid, I was a huge baseball fan. I still am a baseball fan, but I love baseball cards. I love being able to look at the back of a baseball card and see a guy's stats. And it wasn't just stats for Reggie or for Bonds or for Jeter or for A-Rod. Those same stats could be applied to every professional baseball player. And at some point it dawned on me that we didn't have anything like that for professional wrestling. You know how many world titles Flair had. We know how many times Bruno sold out the Garden. But we don't have any data, you know, any numbers that we can point to for all the wrestlers. We have terms like this guy was a main eventer, this guy was a mid-carder, this guy was a preliminary wrestler. But we've never come up with what I call an objective way of quantifying that. So like the nerd that I am, I literally invented one.
Do you have a website that
I do. Is all posted on? Yeah, chartingtheterritories.com. And I basically invented a statistic that I call a spot rating. And it stands for statistical position over time, but it measures a wrestler's average spot on the cards. It's a number from 0 to 1. And the higher the number is, the higher up the cards they were. So if somebody like Andre the Giant or Flair or Harley was always in the main event, their spot rating would be a 1.00. Guys who wrestled in the mid cards would have a spot rating between a 0.4 and a 0.6. Preliminary wrestlers would be lower than that. And I basically came up with this way of quantifying a wrestler's role because not everybody was a main eventer. Some of these guys started lower on the cards and worked their way up. And some guys just were mid-carders their whole career. They were a full-time professional wrestler, just like the first baseman that played for, you know, the Marlins that never, you know, made the All-Star game, never won a batting title, but he was a pro for 10 years. We've got stats for him, and now we're going to start having stats for all these wrestlers as well.
Hey, Phil, you can highlight what I'm sharing right now. I'm sharing his website, and that could be shown on the actual podcast so people can get an idea of what the website looks like.
Yeah, what we do, we basically cover one territory a month on the website with a PDF file that you can download that has all sorts of data and charts and graphs. Then we also do a podcast where instead of boring charts and numbers and graphs, the podcast is where we go more in depth about the territory and talk a little bit about some of the wrestlers that were there. And again, not just the main eventers, but we try and dig deep into the wrestling careers and sometimes out of the ring exploits of a lot of the wrestlers that people have heard of. But if you were given a quiz, if Donnie's brother, you know, gave them a quiz, they might not pass. They could say, I've heard the name, but I don't know much about him. Hopefully after listening to our podcast and going to the website and reading my books, you at least get a little more information about them as humans and not just, you know, the highlights of their wrestling career.
Wrestling education through osmosis is how I would put it.
Well, it sure beats trying to hit somebody over the head with the book.
Now, Gets, where did you first get the idea? Like to start this, like obviously this became before internet and everything else, like, did you have this idea when you were a kid? Like, how did you come up with this?
Definitely not as a kid, but at some point, so I worked as a wrestling manager from the mid 90s through about 07, 08. And then I left. I thought I'd left wrestling forever in 2008. And somehow, some way, I came back in 2015. I was working as an indie manager again. And in the middle of a show, I took a bump poorly, and I broke my leg in 4 places.
Mm. Oof, I remember.
And that, I decided at that point, all right, I am never, at that point, I'm in my mid-40s. I'm never going to take a bump again, but I still have a passion for wrestling. And so I basically merged it with my other passion, which is statistics and data. I used to work full-time as an actuary. I have degrees in actuarial science and finance, so I'm a big numbers guy. And I basically was trying to figure out, you know, what kind of statistic can I make that does this? And as you look at cards from back in the days of the territories, there was a very strict order to the matches on the card. Nowadays, they always try and start out with a big match, and they sort of have like an ebb and a flow pattern, like a roller coaster of ups and downs. But back in the 60s and 70s and up through the early 80s, the opening match typically featured preliminary wrestlers and was a much slower paced match and not important. And the main event was the most important thing on the card. And it was what they hit really hard on all the promos on TV. And it's what the fans came to see. And so gradually from the opening match all the way up to the main event, there are wrestlers of varying importance along the way. And so it dawned on me that if I could quantify that, if I could come up with a number that measures a guy's spot, then we would have something that you know, it can be used to quantify a wrestler's role in the territories.
Hmm. Now, let me ask you, guys, the formula and the equations and all that you're using from yesteryear, let's say it's 25 years from now. Do you think those state you could extrapolate the companies from today and the wrestlers today using that same formula, and would it generate the same information and same data?
It probably wouldn't. As I mentioned earlier, nowadays there is a different flow to a wrestling card. Also, nowadays they put tickets on sale months before the show and months before a single match is announced. Back in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, they ran most of their towns every single week. So they run a show, let's say Tuesday night, and then on Saturday's TV, they say, last week, this happened. Because of that, this is what's going to be the main event this Tuesday night. And the ticket sales determined whether that feud was a success or not. The more people that came to the show to see that specific main event that they just advertised 2 days earlier, the more successful those wrestlers were and the more times they would face one another in the future. Nowadays, just the way it's set up, also even the TV shows, Raw and Dynamite and all the other shows, they start with a hot match or a hot promo to get you invested, and then they sort of bring things down. And then if it's a show that's longer than an hour, they always have a big angle right at the end of 1 hour and before the beginning of another one, because they want people to stay from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. They don't want them to change the channel. There's probably a way, and actually I have talked with Chris Harrington, who works for AEW.
That was going to be my next question. This is where I'm going, guys.
He actually came up with a very early iteration of what I do with the spot rating as a component of some things he did years and years ago. But he, you know, he knows how to look at the short-term gain or decline in ratings to sort of measure a wrestler's importance. So the calculations I do as they stand now only apply for what I call the prime territorial era, which is basically the 60s and the 70s, from the day from in between the two big booms in television. So starting with the end of wrestling on the Dumont Network in the late 50s and going up through the birth of cable TV in the early 80s. What I do focuses on the period in between those two eras.
So we're going to add just a quick other voice to the conversation. Bufa is waiting.
Oh,
hey, Bufa, welcome.
Hey, yo,
Bufa, yo, I don't know if you know Mr. Have you ever met Al Getz, Bufa?
No, but I've heard of him.
Of course you have. Al Getz, Bufa, you used to be one of All Money is Legal.
Okay.
In the Jersey All Pro days. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Now he's Mr. International.
What up, man?
And where are you at tonight? Where are you now?
I'm in Glasgow. I'm in Glasgow. I'm out. I'm doing some promotion, you know, meeting the locals, you know.
See, guess you would be fascinated by Bufa because he's an international traveler. He's all over China. He's in Glasgow, Scotland. So he's over in those. Now, is any of your stuff international as well, Getz, or is it mostly U.S.-based?
So far, I've stuck with the U.S. and Canada. At some point, I hope to go past that. I hope to, you know, go to Japan and Mexico. And then over time, we keep finding more and more records of shows in countries that we didn't even know they had wrestling at. I was actually talking with Brian Blair a few weeks ago from the Killer Bees. And, you know, he remembers, you know, he used to go on these random tours all the time in the 90s in between shows for Herb Abrams. He'd go to the Philippines for a month. He'd go, you know, he'd go to countries he didn't even remember. And so he sort of challenged me. He's like, you know, what can we do to figure out, you know, where all these international tours were? Yeah. And it's you know, a lot of ways it's like detective work. I liken it to Pokemon. You know, we're trying to find all these records, and every now and then you accidentally fall ass backwards into a Pikachu or, you know, whatever the other. That's the only Pokemon I know.
I do know for a fact that Bruce Pritchard has a pretty extensive collection of records, and I can't remember. He bought somebody's collection or got his hands on it. Whose was it? Do you remember, Getz?
I don't know. I know there's a few people that collect that. I will say people that think they have complete records, when I look at them, I know they're not. You know, we always understood that wrestlers, you know, if you ask Hogan and Flair, they would say they wrestled 9 days a week, even though there's only days a week. They somehow claimed, because they would go back and forth to Japan and the time zone would change, that they were able to get 9 shows in a week. That's not true, but they did wrestle a solid 5-6 days a week, you know, throughout the 70s. But when we look at the career record books that have been compiled for wrestlers, there's barely 200 matches a year for most of these guys. So we're missing possibly 100 other. We might be missing 50% of what they had. So over the last few years, we've sort of dug into newspaper archives, both online and by me actually physically traveling to libraries and state archives and going through old newspapers on microfilm and finding new shit. And that, like I said, it's like Pokemon. Like finding new things. We find a show or you find a town that you didn't know had weekly wrestling that nobody recalled. And it's so cool to add those to the existing data.
Now, have you ever had the chance, or I'm assuming you have, but have you ever been to what I guess would be considered the vault, the secret vault, the lair where most of the records in the US probably are? And that's Mr. Jim Cornette's attic.
I have not been to Cornette's attic. That's on the list. Of course, also Brian Last years ago acquired Norm Keitzer's archives.
That's so what I was thinking of. Yep.
He's got a lot of stuff too. Cornette does. Carrie Silkin has developed a pretty good collection of old wrestling posters. There's also at Notre Dame University, they have a collection of files from Jack Pfeffer, literally correspondence and photos and programs from like 50 years worth of stuff. And there are people that have gone and visited there and literally they'll just find a hotel room and they'll just, you know, go there every day for a week or 2 weeks and barely scratch the iceberg. More and more places like that are popping up and becoming known, and people like myself and other historians are traveling to these places and just trying to acquire all these records.
Now, Bufa, over where you are internationally, are there people like Al Getz or Cornette or Jim?
Oh, there's nobody like Al Getz anyway. Well,
you know, that's true. But are there people over there who are the gatekeepers of the history internationally? Do you know any of those folks?
Yes, I do. And I can provide a lot of these results because when was it? Back in 2019, I was on a tour in China where I wrestled literally twice a day for 3 weeks straight. There's so many tours I've done. They're not even in the record books. Like, you go to Cage Match.
Yeah, that's like, what I'm wondering.
Then, like, I've been traveling to Japan since 2011, and there's probably, like, not even half of my results up there, you know? So Cage Match isn't as accurate as people think, you know?
No,
I'm starting to learn that. They're not as complete, and in some cases, they're not as accurate as people think. And so, you know, slowly over time, there are people working to correct what's up there that's incorrect and also to complete that is incomplete. And I see sirens, Bufa. Are you in trouble? Do you need to run?
Be careful, good, Bufa. I'm good. Be careful.
Remember, I'm no longer in New York City, so I feel a little safer here.
Getz, let me ask you, with this skill set that you have, the analyzation of talent, the placement on cards, ticket sales, everything that you're able to analyze. If you were able to do that for today's talent, I'm just hypothetically, I have to believe that it would be a huge benefit for somebody to have somebody like you on their payroll to do a function like this and see who the audience is buying, who they're not buying. When tickets go on sale, when certain talents are announced, like I cannot for the life of me, as I'm sitting here listening to this, figure out how you were not on the payroll of either TKO or Tony Khan at this point. Have you ever had any kind of discussions with anyone? And if you don't want to say, that's fine. But have you ever been approached by either company? You're the only statistician in the world doing this. Like, how are you not on their payroll?
Well, Donnie, let me add a little bit of more color to this, because when you want to document history, you got to have someone that sees the value to document it. And that's where Al comes into play.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, I have not been approached by either major company, nor have I approached them. Part of it, I'm very happily retired in my personal life and enjoy my freedom. Working for either of those two companies would be not just a full-time commitment, but typically more than a full-time commitment. As I mentioned, Chris Harrington earlier, he is not just a 9-to-5, guy. He is literally living and breathing AEW, going to the shows and all that. I definitely think there's value in, even though wrestling today is different in so many ways from wrestling in the past, and how wrestling companies make their money is different as well. Mm-hmm. Understanding what drove revenue in the past, at the very least, couldn't hurt today. And certainly there are ways to apply the statistics I've created for the past, but also, you know, going in with an open mind and looking at what they're doing today and trying to figure out how to come up with, as you said, some sort of measurements today. What I would say is I don't expect a phone call, but I would listen. I would absolutely listen. I don't know.
You would entertain the conversation.
I would entertain the conversation because, you know, it's cool if you know, and you mentioned not just working for a company, but working for a wrestler. When you said that, it made me think of arbitration in baseball.
Yes.
So after a few years, players can choose to go into arbitration where they submit what they want salary wise and the team submits another number, and they basically go and argue their case in front of not a jury, but in front of an arbitration board that chooses one of those two numbers. So certainly for a wrestler, someone like Max, our pal Max Friedman from Long Island, just like me, originally from Long Island. Certainly when it comes time to renegotiate contracts, having data could be very valuable. And to show Tony Khan, you know, when I'm in this segment, this is what happened. Here was ticket sales for Wembley. And then here's what happened after you announced my particular match for Wembley. Things like that can definitely show the value of a wrestler to their employer or to a potential employer. He could show those same stats to, you know, to Vince and say, here's the revenue I drove when I was with AEW. I feel I can do the same for you if you put me in the spot. Therefore, pay me $8 million.
And I was looking at looking at it the other way. From the company's point of view, let's say Bufa's getting seven figures a year, and he comes to us and goes, "Hey, listen, I need $10 million a year." And I go, "Well, hold on a minute. This is what the numbers show. You know what? You're underbidding yourself, but I'm not going to tell him that. He could probably get 15 out of us." You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, yes. So I think it could be from either side, the talent side or the office side myself.
I absolutely agree. It could go either way. It could, you know, help the promotion when negotiating with talent. It could help the talent when negotiating with promoters. And of course, my good friend Bill Barons, who I've worked with for many years for Wildside. Donnie was a Backstreet Boy for one day in Wildside.
Yes,
sir. I remember when the Briscoes used to come down. It was so funny because Wildside had TV in New Jersey. And it was the best way for you guys to get exposed in New Jersey was to drive down to Georgia and work for Wildside.
Cornelia, Georgia, right?
Yep, Cornelia, Georgia. And they were on
it was 14-hour drive.
GTW, Channel 48 in Philly.
Yep. Johnny, we drove. It was 14 hours with the Reverend Ron Starr at the wheel. We got in his van. Wow. We stopped at Krispy Kreme, loaded up for Ron. That's all he wanted. We did the show, got in the van, and came back home.
Yep.
So was that wrestling in Chinese cinema on Channel 48? That's what I remember.
I think Channel 48, I think they had a few wrestling shows that were on at the time. Maybe CZW was on it as well.
Yeah.
But Wildside was, I think ECW was, because Bill ended up, you know, getting a lot of indie promotions on TV far outside, you know, where they ran shows, just getting into all sorts of major markets.
So Donnie asked the question about, you know, maybe, you know, a promotion, you know, snagging you up. What about operating as a consultant for like an independent company, like maybe like Pro Wrestling Magazine, and, you know, providing your stats at a, like a certain cadence, and you would just act as a consultant? What about that?
That's sort of been not a goal, but an idea I've had the last few years. I've spent the last few years building up my credibility and my following. And it's not easy to start from scratch. And you know, believe me, I know how many books I've sold. I ain't getting rich off this stuff, but each time a new book comes out, more and more people buy it. More and more people go back and buy the old books. Every new podcast, we typically have more listeners than the month before.
It's the exposure that.
But I would love to, I know I've actually written some stuff for Slam Wrestling, the website slamwrestling.com, which is based in Canada. Greg Oliver runs that site. He's actually asked me to do some things for him. I would love to work for you know, do some stuff for the magazines for PWI. I know they have Brian Solomon as their in-house historian. And he's a really good guy. He wrote the book on the Sheik that came out last year. It's okay. A fantastic book. It's called Blood and Fire. One of the best biographies on a wrestler you'll ever read. So he's sort of their guy now. But I'm, you know, I the idea would be not necessarily license my stats, but once people see what I do and say, hey, what, you know, can you write something about Dusty Rhodes for, you know, for a book I'm working on? Can you write something about, you know, the Sheik or Abdullah or whoever for an article I'm doing? I'd be happy to provide, you know, my information, my research, my data to help, you know, fill out the book. That's something I'm absolutely open to.
So I have a question. And before you got on, Donnie was going into about tribal knowledge that is lost in wrestling. How much tribal knowledge do you think was lost when Kevin Sullivan passed away?
Goodness gracious. Yeah, that's, I mean, he was a guy. Kevin Sullivan was everywhere. He started as a rookie in Georgia. He worked in Gulf Coast in 1971 at a time when a wrestler named Bobby Shane came in to work as a heel for the first time in his career. Bobby Shane started wrestling when he was 18 years old. He was always billed as a young babyface, you know, a young up-and-coming babyface star. For 5-6 years, wrestled all over the country. And they sent him down to Gulf Coast, which was a territory that just didn't get a lot of coverage in the magazines. And they said, you're going to work as a heel here. If it works, if you get over, we're going to have you start working as a heel everywhere else. If not, no one will ever know, and you'll just come back to, you know, Kansas and Texas and wherever as a babyface. So he works as a heel. He draws 9,000 fans to Mobile, Alabama, to take on the promoter who came out of retirement for, like, you know, one final match type deal. He got over huge. He billed himself as the king of wrestling. In fact, Jerry Lawler got the idea to be the king from Bobby Shane. And it's been said that Bobby Shane gave him the actual crown that Shane had used that Lawler then started using when he was the king. So Sullivan was there for that. Then Sullivan goes to Tennessee and learns and gets to, you know, be an up-and-coming babyface, teaming with some of the biggest stars, Tojo Yamamoto, Bearcat Brown, Len Rossi, Jerry Jarrett, Lawler, and just see how an undersized wrestler can get over. And then Sullivan, even though he's one of the shortest, you know, guys out there, became a huge star as a heel. It's really hard for a short guy to be a heel in a territorial era because they're used to having monsters like Abby, you know, and big tall guys. And now I see we've got a bunch of shirtless guys in a parking lot joining us.
Really quick run from Johnny Cashmere and the Backseat Boys. How are things going in Ohio?
Good. We're about 20 minutes from bell time. We have a 6-man tag we're working on. I don't know if you guys can see the ring a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you guys want to pop right across the street?
Is that a cornfield?
It's a cornfield.
You made it, Johnny.
I did make it. Yes, exactly.
Johnny, you remember Al Getz, correct?
Al, how you doing, man? I'm a huge fan, brother. I'm the one that thought of the name of the show, As Good As It Gets. That was mine, brother.
Heel play. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah.
No, proper Mark.
Yeah, if I recall, you and Trent weren't working for Dennis when I was up working for Dennis. But I think, was it some, like, either Kettner's shows or Blaine DeSantis's shows? Ran into you guys a few times. And God, you guys... Oh, you're so talented. It's so cool to see guys that I haven't seen in 20 years still kicking. The thing that makes me feel old is when I see wrestlers nowadays that I remember when they were little kids. Freaking Colby Carino.
Yeah.
I remember that kid was 4 years old watching Blue's Clues in Rayford, North Carolina. And now he's a grown-ass man, and he's a big, you know, big, you know, up-and-coming guy with the NWA.
Bro, I remember when he was born. Like,
he's a dad of his own right now.
Yeah, he's a kid of his own. Carino's a grandfather.
Yeah.
That's great. How's it going out there, Juggalos?
So far, so good. We're going to be camping tonight, I think, underneath the stars and the cornfield. We're first wrestling here at the bar. It's a free event. for all the Juggalos. So there's a lot of people here already. It's about to get started. So
real quick, I want to take the time and remind everybody, Trip TV Episode 5 will be airing exclusively on SPO Wrestling Facebook. Unfortunately, it will not be up on YouTube this evening. We're working on a future date for that, but live at 8 o'clock p.m. as soon as the SPOcast is done, facebook.com/SPOWrestling, and check out Trip TV Episode 5, y'all.
Is it 5 or 4?
Awesome.
It's 5. 5?
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, we're really excited about tonight, you guys, but I just want to remind everyone, keep checking our stories because we're going to be updating over the next few days. And I got to say, I saw what's going on with the Feral Face. It's supposed to be tagging with me that these Kogar brothers challenged me in Face. I just want you to know that I'm on top of it. I got some phone calls out and I'm going to see what's going on. But right now I got too much else to worry about. So guys, thanks for having us. We're going to head back.
All right, guys. Check in the end of the week.
Be safe.
What's up?
That was an accident. Boofa. I'm near controls.
Boofa, are you a Juggalo? Boofa, are you a Juggalo posse? Are you a Juggalo? What a Juggalo? A Juggalo, right? Are you a Juggalo?
I'm a Juggalo.
I would have to say yes because thanks, Johnny Casimir. I got a chance to wrestle for them at one of their Hollow Wicked events like years ago.
Oh, really? Against AT.
Yep.
They run a hell of a promotion. Gats, are you? I had no idea how big in scope their deal was, man. It's amazing.
They really have a good thing going. So I was supposed to work a show with ICP. It wasn't a Juggalo Championship Wrestling show. It was a show promoted by Ron Neamey in Florida.
Okay.
He ran IPW Hardcore Wrestling.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, ICP, they had travel issues and could not make the show. And you want to talk about 1,000 really pissed off Juggalos. Yeah. I'm looking at the comments. There have been some people asking questions about what I do, and I do want to
answer them. Go ahead.
Address them. Yeah.
Feel free.
So someone asked if I'd given thought about expanding into the 80s. Nothing is off limits. What I'd say is I intentionally am focusing on the early 70s because that is a time period that does not get talked about as much as others. There's a lot of stuff about the 80s going forward because, of course, we have the tapes and we have the cable TV. There's a lot of great books on the 80s. There's also a lot of great books on the 60s and the 50s and even before that. But the early 70s, like 71 through 76, is sort of a dead area for wrestling. And so I've chosen to cover that to help give it its flowers, so to speak. Someone also asked me if it could be applied to indie wrestling. It depends on the promotion. I actually helped somebody. He actually did it for CZW in the first 10 years of the 2000s. And I looked at the output, and it actually looked pretty good. So for some promotions, it still could work. Even if every show doesn't have opening match building its way to the top, even if they sort of zigzag the order of the matches, over time, the guy that works last most often is the guy that's most important to the promotion or girl. We gotta respect the times nowadays where lots of promotions have some great women wrestlers that are drawing huge crowds. Certainly, you look at the women's division in the major leagues and on the indies. I've known you guys know Billy Starks, right?
Mm-hmm,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I've known her since she just started wrestling, and from day one as like a 16-year-old, she said, you know, she was going to make it big, and she had the drive and the work ethic. She also was incredibly professional backstage in how he handled herself, mm-hmm. how she handled herself even at a young age. So from day one, I was a personal fan of hers, and she's just an incredible in-ring talent as well. And to see her getting opportunities now with Ring of Honor, where her and Athena are the draws in Ring of Honor. They're absolutely the most fascinating acts they've got going on Ring of Honor. And it's great to see both of them in those roles.
Yeah. So Al, I have a question. So you highlighted 71 to 76 being this dead era. Mm-hmm. So what matches, if you were going to be like the historian, what matches would be the top three that you could say you have to watch these and you would get an education on?
Well, here's where I'm going to not answer your, I'm going to give an answer that is not at all what you expected. Because nowadays, this focus on analyzing matches is really not in tune with how the product was presented and promoted. Realistically, matches weren't meant to be viewed years later and analyzed. They were meant to entertain the crowd that showed up, that paid their money to see the show that particular night. And then sometimes, you know, things that happened during that match would play into what happens the following week. And sometimes they want you to forget it. They want you to forget that, oh, wait, why is this guy helping that guy? They hated each other last month. So they will conveniently ignore that. Also, we put this emphasis on wrestling matches. I think a wrestling show is actually the product and not just one of the matches on the show. Like we know wrestling matches have what they call a three-part story arc. Mm-hmm. You start with the babyface getting their shine, just like in a movie or in a book. It starts with a slow introduction to the characters and a little happy moment. And then the middle section of the match or the movie or the book is what we call the heat, where drama ensues, shenanigans happen. The bad guy cheats to get the advantage, beats the crap out of the good guy, who then in the final chapter overcomes the odds, and that you build to a finish that usually involves the good guy winning, but not always. And when you look at a wrestling show, a lot of times the show follows that same story arc. You start out with a little slow introduction to wrestling with a couple of the preliminary wrestlers trading holds and not getting too crazy. Then you get to the middle part of the card and you see some of the heels, some of the more colorful characters starting to cheat and starting to let their personalities shine through. And then you build to the main event, which is where they send the fans home happy by having the babyface either win or, you know, sometimes get the crap beat out of them, but still get back on their feet at the end of the show and vow revenge the following week. So house shows in the territorial era really weren't meant to be viewed and analyzed today. I'd say if you're looking at in-ring product, much as we evaluate wrestling today, any matches involving a Briscoe and or a Funk is probably must-see TV. Okay. And of course, in the early 70s is when you have them facing one another a lot, because Dory Jr. is the world heavyweight champion starting the 1970s, but then loses it to Harley, who loses it to Briscoe, to Jack Briscoe, who then loses it to Terry Funk. So to set all of those title switches up, you have multiple matches across many territories between the Briscoes and the Funks. And those are great to just sit back and watch. You don't need to know a storyline. You don't need to know an angle. You just need to know it's Jack Briscoe and Dory or Terry Funk, and it's going to kick ass.
And then my final question, and I'll let everybody else in here, is we see the age of, you know, cinema and wrestling kind of follow the same tropes as, like, so we saw the golden age of, like, in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s of movie cinema. And a lot of that is what you just said, is like movies like The Godfather follow that same type of arc. Movies like the original trilogy for Star Wars follow that same kind of cadence. And how much is wrestling so embedded in our culture that every genre, whether it's movies, music, TV, has pulled from it? And what do you think the impact of wrestling in general did?
And I don't know in that case which is the chicken and which is the egg, whether it was pop culture pulling from wrestling or wrestling pulling from pop culture or both, or it was a symbiotic relationship. Perhaps over time, people just figured out that this is what works. This is what draws viewers in, or draws consumers in, and keeps them coming back. So you mentioned the Star Wars trilogy. Not only was the trilogy following that arc, but each movie within the trilogy followed that arc as well. So we talked about a wrestling match having a arc and a wrestling show having an arc, but each match in that show also has its own arc. So
it's that layered onion approach.
Right. And that's just what gets people invested and hooked in it. And it's worked in all forms of pop culture and media for decades. And, you know, some people say, you know, talk about wrestling nowadays and how intricately in planned it is, and how nowadays on Raw there are, I guess, Easter eggs or callbacks or things where if you're really paying attention, your dedication pays off. But at the same time, you need to keep it really fucking simple. And I heard somebody else curse earlier, so I'm assuming we're allowed.
That'd be me.
You're good.
Yeah. Okay. If not, you know, I'll put a dollar in the swear jar. But back in the day, two guys would fight one another for a couple of reasons, for money, for a title, or for revenge. And it was that simple. And back in that day, usually there was only one main event on a show, so they could emphasize this is why this main event is happening. Nowadays, with so many top stars and so many big matches and title matches and this and that, it almost gets lost in the confusion. I would love to see somebody just, I don't want to say dumb it down, because it's not insulting anyone's intelligence to keep it very basic. But the idea is you want to be able to have someone that's never watched wrestling before, if they tune into Dynamite, they don't get overwhelmed with too much information. Well, this guy's fighting because 3 years ago in this place, they did that. But then after that, this happened. You need one of those like flow charts with the thumbtacks, the strings. Keep it really simple. I liken it to soap operas. Because I used to watch soap operas all the time. And soap operas are amazing because in an episode, a one-hour episode of General Hospital, a lot of things happen. But at the same time, if you miss that episode and tune in the following day, within 5 minutes, you're caught up to speed on what you missed. And you feel like you're right back in the thick of things. If wrestling gets too involved and does too much, you lose that, and you can make it hard to retain fans if they miss a couple of weeks, or to recruit new fans that just, you know, want to watch it for the first time. So keep it simple, silly. I don't want to say stupid. Keep it simple, silly.
So
I was gonna say
today, like, what is it today that you think for you, what is garnering your attention the most that you're latched on to? Like, I see the pop culture connection, I see the where this is sort of trending to be the next big thing, or is the big thing that people aren't really seeing yet. What is percolating for you right now when you watch modern day wrestling?
So I don't watch modern wrestling as much as I used to watch wrestling. I do keep up with it, but as far as watching it live, I'll catch AEW maybe every other week or so. I'll watch the big events for the WWE. I've got some friends that run indie shows around here. I follow that. But what I like to see is when someone gets over organically. And I think the best example of that recently is Swerve. And before that, Hook. They got over big really fast. The problem is when you plan everything out and you have pay-per-view every month and you have to build all your angles to peak at the same time, you don't have the flexibility to just go with the hot hand. I look at wrestling back in the day when Luger first came out. I think he won his first title within like 4 weeks of his debut. Nowadays, you look at somebody like Hook, you see how long it took them to build him up. And back in the day, if he got over huge, they would just go with it. Same thing with Swerve. Obviously, now he is their champion. But back 20 years ago, when he first got hot after the Hangman Page feud, they would have strapped him up right then and there. They wouldn't have said, well, we already have this plan for the next 3 pay-per-views to do this, this, that. They'd say, nope, Swerve is over huge. Let's reward the fans. Let's make them feel that they're influencing decisions, but make them feel that their support of this guy is paying off, is worth it.
Mm-hmm. No, that's 100%. I would say the same thing for LA Knight.
Yeah.
If you talk about guys who got over organically against all odds.
Guys who weren't supposed to get over as big as they did, they weren't even given the ball. They probably took the ball from somebody else and then ran with it, as opposed to being given the ball first. So I like seeing guys like that, especially nowadays where everything is so planned, and not just for the next pay-per-view, but for several pay-per-views at a time. To see companies rewarding guys who get over almost against script that weren't supposed to, it's great to see Tony, or even nowadays Hunter, saying, you know, if LA Knight is this over, then he's going to be the guy to beat Logan Paul.
That's great.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got 5.5 minutes until the next episode of Trip TV airing on Facebook, on SPO Facebook page.
Great show, by the way. Whoever's doing that is doing great production. The whole thing is, I watched a couple of them over the last couple of days. They were great, man. Really well done. Everything you guys are doing, and Gats too, like, all the stuff you guys are doing is so out of the box and so revolutionary, in my opinion, because there's not many people doing it. It just makes it stand out. And
you're welcome.
I've had people ask me, Gats, How many books have you written, and where can we get them? Where can we get this stuff?
I've written 5 books so far. Each of them covers a 3-year period in the life of one territory. And you can get them worldwide on Amazon. Just search for Charting the Territories, Al Getz. If you're crazy enough to want an autographed copy, and you live in the 48 lower United States, you can go to chartingtheterritories.com to order one or all 5 of my books. But not only do I focus on a time period that doesn't get represented a lot, my books so far have covered territories that don't get talked about as much as Florida or Mid-Atlantic or the WWWF. I focus on the Central States Territory in Kansas and Missouri, Gulf Coast in Alabama and Florida, and also Leroy McGurk's territory, which was Oklahoma and Louisiana before Bill Watts took over and, wow, and started Mid-South wrestling.
Amazing,
so
dude,
if you're interested in learning about territories that you might not be familiar with from a time period you might not be familiar with, these are the books for you. And hopefully over time I will get to the bigger territories and maybe even go into the late 70s and early 80s where there's guys like Buddy Landell and Dundee and Tracy Smothers, guys that Donnie and I used to work with.
Yeah.
One of my jobs when I worked for Dennis Coraluzzo was to deliver Buddy Landell to the show in a condition that he was able to wrestle.
We used to say you were on buddy duty. You were yes, on buddy duty. I'd be like, hey, get your own buddy duty this weekend.
And just to be very clear, every time I was with Buddy, he was at the show on time and performed 100%.
I have
is,
nothing.
Given what we know about yes, Buddy, is not a gimme.
So, but I will say this right on this show in front of Getz. Every dealing I ever had with Buddy Landell, he could not have been more of a gentleman. He did whatever was asked. He worked hard. He was exemplary in the locker room. Yes, he had demons and he fought them. You know, many have and many have lost. They never lose. Father Time's undefeated also.
Yep.
But I loved Buddy Landell. Such a nice gentleman. I wish things had played out differently just from a humanitarian aspect so he could still be here living his later years. Forget wrestling. Mm-hmm. Just as a human being, the class and dignity he showed Ratchet and a lot of the other youngsters in the locker room when he didn't have to was something I don't forget. And I loved my time with Buddy Landell as well as you. And yep, this has been awesome, bro. I definitely want to have you on again. And just this is my call to everyone who listens to this show. If you're in the goddamn wrestling business, these should be your encyclopedias. I don't understand how anyone at the, like I said, the PC or the NIL athletes or anyone thinking about a career in professional wrestling can't have this by their bedside and just read a few pages a night and understand where the hell this whole thing came from and the trends that made men successful. It made men rich and it made men poor because they didn't follow the trends. They didn't listen to the data. And I'm not the biggest stat guy in the world because I don't really understand a lot of it. But Al writes this in a way that you can understand it. It's easily digestible. And you are an absolute fool if you don't learn from these books and these stellar pieces of art, in my opinion. And it's been awesome having you here, bro.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for having me on. We put this together just a few days ago. Yep. You know, like, oh, hey, dude, we should get you on the podcast. I'm like, all right. What the hell?
Yeah,
let's do it.
What we want to do. We want to be the positive podcast. There's so many out there where people just bitch and moan and complain the entire hour or two. I don't want to do that. I want to focus on positivity, and we will definitely 100% have you on again. But that's it, man. This was a great show. Phil, Chris, everybody, man. It was just fantastic tonight, guys.
We got 1 minute left, and it's the final countdown.
Remember, it's going to be facebook.com/SpoWrestling. Go over there for the next episode of Trip TV. Thank you all for being here
this week.
Thank
you, Boofa. Yes.
And Boofa. Boofa messaged me. He was having some connection issues.
Yeah, we'll get him on next week. He's a regular. And Getz, I want you on again 100%. If there's any time you ever want to come on and plug something or you got something new coming out, don't hesitate. And for God's sakes, Trips, the TKO, Tony, anybody out there, man, get this guy on your staff, even if it's a consigliere or a consultant or something. This is the guy, man. You will not lose money with him on your payroll. It is impossible. This is Billy Bean here. This is Moneyball. You know what I mean? This is what it is, bro. I mean, it's fucking right here in front of him. So God bless you, brother. I'm so glad you were on, and it's good to see you alive and well, man.
Yeah, great seeing you too. I think the last time I saw you in person was at the Guns N' Roses concert.
That's right, GNR, bro.
Yep, that was awesome.
Two old guys living out our dreams. Thank you again, bro.
Thanks for having me, and Phil and Chris, great talking to you guys as well. And awesome. And Bufa, wherever he is in Glasgow, running from the law, even though he said he wasn't. I think that's what happened.
I do too.
Yeah.
Thank you, buddy.
We'll find out about it next week.
Wrong, sir. Wrong.